I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're talking about the unprecedented drop in U.S. abortion rates during the Obama administration, which researchers attribute to increased access to and use of contraceptives.
We'll also take a look at Church Clarity, a new tool church shoppers can use to learn whether a congregation is affirming of LGBT members or non-affirming.
And for our deep dive, we'll discuss the meeting this weekend of two of Trump's biggest supporters and apologists, Sean Hannity and Dallas pastor Robert Jeffress.
Before we get to our main stories, we'll each start with a quick hit on a story we've been following. Nish, what's on your mind?
Oh, what's on my mind, Amy? This past week, I found out that a very popular religious blog hosting site called Patheos has decided to give former Mars Hill in Seattle pastor Mark Driscoll a platform. They gave him space to host his blog, and the evangelical world has been pretty up in arms about it, and rightfully so. For those of you who are not aware of Mark Driscoll and Mars Hill, Mark Driscoll, the best way to describe Mark Driscoll is he was a bully. Wouldn't you say that? He was a bully.
He was a bully, a misogynist. He had lots of fantastic qualities.
Yes, he was a bully. He was a misogynist. He was accused of misusing church funds. He made a lot of effort to consolidate power. Just bad news, really bad news for Mars Hill. And when he stepped down, the church went through a process and they actually dissolved. And so Mars Hill Church in Seattle, as we know it, no longer exists. And for Patheos to give this guy a platform that he doesn't necessarily need. Like he went ahead and decided to start a new church in Phoenix without any of that reconciliation work. Like he has not made amends with anyone in his congregation in Seattle, which is problematic in its own right.
Because there's always a second chance for a white male pastor who wants to move on without apologizing.
That's exactly right. There's always a second chance for these guys. And he took that second chance. He started a new church. There are people attending. And he is coming back into the spotlight slowly. And Patheos just decided, hey, that's a good idea. Let's give this guy even more platform, which is really frustrating. One of the biggest reasons why I find it frustrating is not only was this guy a bully, he was a misogynist, like all horrible, horrible things, but his behavior and the way he treated congregants and the way he treated people who disagreed with him was, a lot of people would say it's abusive. And giving someone that with that kind of behavior even more of a platform feels like, you can't even call it a slap in the face. It feels like a twist of the knife, right? Like it's so hurtful. It's terrible that we would give guys like this even more of a platform than they already have. But at the same time, we give guys who do a lot worse the presidency. So I guess it just kind of falls right along with regular culture, right? So I don't know.
Right. If that's going to be our bar now.
Right. So happy that the bar is that low. It's ugh, gross. Anyway, so that is what has caught my eye this week. I wish it was happier news, but it's been really interesting to watch the evangelical response. And it's actually been pretty universal across the board, even from folks who are more conservative, who would actually agree with some of his theology, have said, yeah, this is a bad idea. Why would you do that? So in some ways, it's been really reassuring to see, oh, we all can agree that this is a bad idea. And so far, I have not seen many Mark Driscoll apologists. So we'll see how that develops.
Which is a small silver lining.
Small silver lining. I will take it. You know what? I will take what I can get in these times, Amy. What has caught your eye this week?
So this is obviously a story lots of people have been paying attention to, but because we we have some other bigger things to get into, I wanted to make sure that we at least mentioned it, which is Trump focusing on and even going after the Gold Star widow of Sergeant Johnson, who was killed in Niger earlier in October. Most people have seen the news on this. It is just so, so incredibly sad and just unnecessary that this family that is dealing with such loss also has to deal with the President of the United States just not even being able to do the simple act of apologizing for a phone call that he appears to have screwed up, as we probably could have assumed he would do. Yeah.
And, like, not even just, like, screwed up a phone call. He, like, lied about this woman. He lied about the widow of a Green Beret who died honorably serving his country. Like, I cannot even, oh my gosh, I can't even wrap my brain around it. It just makes me so mad.
Yeah. There's nothing redeemable about it. But what really just bothers me, particularly given all of the support that he's had from his core evangelicals, who can find nothing to criticize him about, is the fact that he's going after a widow. And if there's one class in the Bible that's kind of protected above all others, or at least held up as a class of people who need to be cared for and supported, it's widows. Evangelical pastor Rob Schenck tweeted about this earlier this week, where he said, "I hope my fellow evangelicals advise POTUS that widow's status in the New Testament is exalted and the command is to weep, care for, and serve them, period. Certainly not go after them, lie about them, and imply that they are liars." It's horrific. And again, it's just, I wish this family could grieve in peace, because it's not like it's not like things are happy and fine without the president going after them. He's just making a sad situation so much, much worse.
So much worse. And he ended up dragging his chief of staff, John Kelly, into it, who lost a son in combat. I mean, all of this really started over the fact that he hadn't said anything about what happened in Niger for 12 days. Right? We hadn't heard anything about it. It was 12 days before he said anything about what happened in Niger. And then, of course, all of the conversation turned to whether or not he had made phone calls to these Gold Star families and to anyone who had lost their lives, not just in Niger, but in other areas of the world since he has taken the presidency. And then he ended up dragging his chief of staff into it, who lost a son, and said, well, ask John Kelly if Obama had made a call to him. And, but then John, you know, he took the podium and defended Trump. And oh my gosh, it just turned into this whole thing. But at the bottom line, like the very baseline thing, is that there's a family grieving. There are multiple families grieving right now. And he is completely incapable of the, like, basic human response of empathy. He's completely incapable of it, and this just highlighted it. And I just, it's another reason where I ask the question, how did this guy get the presidency? How did we let this happen? It's just so sad. It's so sad.
Well, let's move on and talk about the big stories of the week. A study in the Journal of Public Health dropped a bombshell last week, reporting that the U.S. abortion rate dropped 25% between 2008 and 2014.
It's huge.
That is enormous. It's unprecedented, and it is something that should be applauded from all corners. As it stands right now, the abortion rate now is as low as it was when abortion was illegal. That fact alone should have huge implications for the abortion debate and how we talk about it, but only if anyone cared to focus on it.
Yes, if only, Amy, if only one would care to focus on the fact that Democratic policies actually result in a lower abortion rate, why would that matter? Why would we want to care about that? Oh my gosh. Anyway, I know you get fired up about this. What are your What was your initial response when you read the story?
My initial response was that this is more data for my pet argument, which is that people who oppose abortion, who think of themselves as pro-life, should support politicians and policies to expand contraception access, period. I know that there are going to be that exception of people who believe that birth control is itself abortion and don't believe that it is moral to use birth control. But most of the polling we have show that that is a less than 5% of the American public. There may be people who don't want other people to use birth control because they don't want to encourage sexual activity, even though we can get into the research there. There is not evidence right now, and certainly not among teenagers, not among older Americans, to show that wider access to contraception leads to more sexual activity. But all this is to say that just the general question of should we increase contraception access should have a resounding yes answer from everybody across the board, but especially people who oppose abortion and don't want abortion numbers to be high. That is not the case, as we've seen. I mean, the administration even now is rolling back part of the contraception mandate under Obamacare, which means we know that there will be fewer women who have their contraception covered, and therefore there will be more abortions. We just know that. One does lead to the other. Anybody who says it's possible to get the abortion rate to zero in the U.S. is lying. And they are lying in order to manipulate pro-life voters. And that is what drives me just up a wall, is we have the debate framed almost in terms of principles. And I understand people have principles that matter to them. But we know that we will not get the abortion rate to zero. So I know a lot of folks, and particularly in the last election cycle, who just despised Trump, who did not want to vote for Trump, but they felt that because of this issue, because they oppose abortion, that they could not vote for Hillary Clinton. They were somehow convinced that to do so would be to encourage more abortions. When, in fact, when we look at these policies, voting for a Democrat, even if Democrats support Roe and support abortion rights, the fact is that the practical result of their policies is to lower abortion rates. I get so angry about this because I feel like good pro-life people are being manipulated in order to serve the cause of Republican politics, not in order to reduce the abortion rate.
That's exactly right. Access to health insurance that includes contraceptives is an explicitly pro-life issue. It is an explicitly even anti-abortion issue. I would actually say that. Because abortion is a result of what we would call unwanted or unplanned pregnancy, right? And so for those of us who want to reduce the number of abortions, a good place to start is giving women access to affordable contraception and therefore more control over whether they get pregnant. Because I don't know if people know this, the thing about birth control, when used correctly, and depending on the method, can be up to 99.9% effective in stopping getting pregnant. Like, this is like 101. Like, this is birth control 101 information. And so the idea that, oh, I can't support this candidate because they're pro-abortion is it is such a crazy argument, because free and affordable access to contraceptives is ultimately going to lower the abortion rate. And so if you actually are anti-abortion, or if you actually do care about the number of abortions happening in this country and you want to reduce it, it is in our best interest to partner and support policies that lower that rate. And this, I mean, the most recent statistic that you're saying, 25% from 2008 to 2014, that is such a huge number, 25%. It is crazy.
But you know what, Nish? There are even better numbers here. And I'm so glad that I have an opportunity to plug my favorite public policy success, maybe ever, but certainly in the last few decades. So work on reducing teen pregnancies or unwanted pregnancies for teenagers has been something I have paid close attention to for the last 15 years or so, because I've been so interested in the debates. And obviously there's been a, you know, go just with abstinence education on one side and, you know, give kids lots of free condoms on the other, when in fact, you know, the reality is that some combination of kids having some more education about their options and ability to say no and consent is important, and having the ability to have safe sex and protected sex and contraceptive sex when they have it is a good way to cut unwanted pregnancies. So since 1990, when the national campaign to reduce teen pregnancy was formed, and since people have been really focusing on this as a policy issue, teen pregnancies have dropped by 63%.
63%?
Do not adjust your headphones. 63%.
Teen pregnancies have dropped 63%.
Yes. Largely through this combination that we know kids are having less sex now than they were 2-3 decades ago, but they are more likely to use contraception when they do have sex. And guess what? That simple little equation has dropped teen pregnancies by 63%. It is astounding. And it is, I would argue, the biggest social policy success that we've had in the last 40 years. And it points us to a way to reduce abortions overall, which is in fact happening right now.
That's amazing. That is that's incredible.
And it's done without making abortion illegal.
Right.
Which is the other thing.
Like, I understand and I sympathize, and there's a lot that I resonate with as someone who considers herself pro-life holistically. There's a lot that I resonate with on making abortion illegal. Like, I understand the argument. I understand the principle, all of it. But to say that the only way to combat the realities of the Roe v. Wade ruling is through the court is incredibly myopic. And these statistics only go to show that, right? That, like, we can attack the abortion rate from all different angles. And things like the ACA and access to contraception for teens and adults, and also access to affordable maternity care. All of these sorts of things attribute to a drop in abortion rates. I have talked to several women who have previously had abortions, and they have all told me that one of the biggest reasons why they did it was let's not even talk about like raising a kid and the cost of raising a kid and the economic realities of having a child, you know, much further down the line. I can attest, I have two of them. They're really expensive. And they continue to be expensive as they get older. I love my children, but they're expensive. But most of these women said, I couldn't afford going to the hospital to have the baby. And the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, mandated that insurance cover certain what we call, quote, essential benefits, which included maternity and newborn care and pediatric services. And it's estimated that 9.5 million previously uninsured women gain access to maternity and prenatal care with the Affordable Care Act. 9.5 million women were able to access ultrasounds, gestational diabetes screenings, lab studies, medications, hospitalization, newborn baby care, including NICU services. If you've ever had a baby in the NICU, it's like you want to talk about cost. NICU is incredibly expensive. Lactation consulting and breast pumps were covered under the ACA, which I know every nursing mom said hallelujah to that when that happened. And this is a big one and really like something I'm really passionate about. Postpartum mental health care was covered under the ACA. That was considered an essential health benefit. And more and more and more. Like 9.5 million women had access to this stuff for the very first time if they became pregnant. And it was such a monumental achievement for women and newborn children. And to have access to that kind of care, to make that kind of care all of a sudden affordable and accessible for women, all of a sudden gives women a bit more of a reason to have that baby because it makes it reasonable.
Right. Well, as you say, we know that the number one reason that women give for having an abortion is economics, financial concerns. And in fact, that's borne out even in these new numbers. We've seen this huge 25% drop, but it's not even across the board. The majority of abortions are being had by women at the lower end of the economic spectrum. And it's not because they get pregnant more often, although, you know, if they have less access to contraceptives, they may, but it's because just simply giving birth and delivery in the hospital with, a bill of thousands and thousands of dollars is tough to cover. We know that raising a child is tough. And one thing that really struck me about these numbers is usually you see abortion rates go up when the economy is bad. And the economy did improve during some points of the Obama administration, but at the beginning, it was not great. We had just had the recession. And yet unwanted pregnancy rates and abortion rates and birth rates continued to go down. And that is what's really astounding, is those two lines don't usually move together. And yet they did in this case. However, our current administration is looking to change some of this and have already started rolling back some of the contraception mandate by way of expanding the definition of who is a religious employer and who therefore can opt out of providing contraception for their employees.
That's right. That's right. Now there's that clause that, I mean, like previously it was for religious objections and it had a very narrow scope, but now it's religious or moral, which like who dictates what that is and who gets to say, you know, what companies can fall under having like a moral objection? Do they have to be religious or do they not have to be? Like there's all sorts of weird questions with this like vague change of language that could make this become, I guess, less accessible, if that makes sense.
Right. Yes. Well, and before we move on to our next topic, I just want to lay out there how impoverished our debate is when it comes to abortion policy, when it disregards this. You know, it drove me nuts that the Obama administration never promoted the ACA as an abortion reduction effort, because I think they missed a golden opportunity to reach out to pro-life voters and to say, hey, you should back this effort. And the flip side of it is you should oppose repeal efforts, because we are actually doing more to reduce abortion rates here than all of those restrictions that are out there. And here, I just want to walk through kind of the arguments, because I've thought them through and I've heard people. And
walk us through it, Amy, step by step. I want to hear it all.
So you talk about overturning Roe v. Wade, which seems to be the be all and end all. Everybody said that all social conservatives cared about with Trump's election was his ability to put another conservative on the Supreme Court. So fine.
Which he did.
So fine. He did. But let's say
stolen seat.
Let's say that Roe v. Wade is overturned. Is abortion illegal across the country? No. Then it goes back to the states, many of which we know would maintain their status quo with regard to abortion access. So states where you can have abortions now, you can probably still have an abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned. states where you couldn't get an abortion that wouldn't make it legal, it's pretty darn hard to get abortions now. I'm not saying that would be a great thing if Roe v. Wade was overturned, but the practical impact is what we need to think about here. The difference is that women would die because there would be more illegal abortions, just like before Roe, and we know what would happen.
It goes underground. It's not safe.
Exactly. So there would be illegal abortions. Would the abortion rate be any lower? As I've, you know, talked about earlier, the abortion rate now is lower than it was when Roe became law. So it's hard to make the argument. You know, it could well drop further, but we're already doing a pretty darn good job and without killing women. So I think there's a good argument to be made to pro-life voters if only the Democratic Party would make it, and if only pro-life voters are willing to listen to it. We'll see. I'm not going to hold my breath, but I personally will continue making that argument because I think it would make for a much healthier discussion of the issue in our country, and it might actually save a lot of lives.
It would save a lot of lives. It would be holistic, like what you were saying. It would not only attack the abortion numbers, but it would also attack women's inability to access affordable health care. It is a win all the way around if we can take our eyes just for one second, not off the court. I'm not saying that, you know, we don't care about abortion issues that reach the court, but we cannot have a myopic view on this anymore. Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. That is the reality of the situation. And the sooner we come to grips with that and start opening our eyes to other ways, holistic ways and helpful ways that we can lower the abortion rate, the better off everyone is going to be, especially when it goes hand in hand in with something like healthcare. I don't know. It just makes all the sense in the world to me. And I hope. This is going to be one of those, I think, dividing line issues for the Democratic Party in the next election. We've already seen it start to fracture even at the Women's March, there were a lot of people saying, like, I hold true to, like, all of these other, you know, tenets of the Women's March, right? Like, I am stoked on all of these different things, but I'm a pro-life person. Am I still welcome? And the response was really interesting, that there was this kind of, like, line in the sand of saying, like, no, you're not. Like, you have to be pro-choice, otherwise you are not welcome, you're not feminist. I mean, however you want to couch it, right? And so this could be a really big fracturing point in the Democratic Party, is how big tent is the Democratic Party willing to be? And if the Democratic Party...
Well, and that is a topic for future discussion, because we could really keep going with that one. So let's maybe move on for right now.
We will table it and come back to it, but
for now we solved the policy issue. So you're welcome, America.
Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to a story that is the talk of evangelical churches this week. Last week, an organization called Church Clarity launched a website of the same name that is intended to clear up confusion about whether individual congregations are affirming of LGBT members or non-affirming. But from the response that has followed, it appears many churches actually like the confusion and aren't too keen to try to clear things up. And for our listeners, I want to go ahead and just explain really quickly what affirming and non-affirming means within the context of the Christian tradition. So to be affirming, and there are a lot of different layers and levels to affirming and non-affirming, so it's a very nuanced and kind of contextualized conversation, but just for the sake of moving this forward, affirming means that you affirm the identity of LGBT people. Traditionally, it means that you believe they have the right to marry, not just, you know, within the context of the state, but also in the church, that there are pastors and clergy that would marry them, and that LGBT people, both those who choose to remain celibate and those who choose to be in same-sex relationships, can serve all the way in the highest levels of the church. Non-affirming is the flip side to that. So to be not affirming means you don't believe that you can be in a same-sex relationship or for transgender people that you can transition to another gender. It means that if you are in an LGBT or if you are in a same-sex relationship, then you cannot serve in the church, that you must remain celibate. So just to give you a little bit of a context, that's what we're talking about. So this website essentially tells you what churches, through crowdsourcing, so you can submit the names and contact information of churches around the country to the website, and they will do the investigative work and determine where, not just where they stand, but how clear they are on the issue. And that is...
Yeah, and that's what's really key about this. I think some people have tried to identify it as pro-LGBT rights.
Right, that's exactly right.
Trying to point people to affirming churches. And, you know, that will be one outcome for folks who are looking for affirming churches. But
sure,
what it really does is identify those churches who have been very clear in outlining what their stand is, and those that are unclear and maybe muddying the waters purposefully or not purposefully.
Yeah, I mean, if you go and look at the website, it's super interesting. Like, it categorizes unclear, discerning, clear, and so you get like a yellow, green, red, like there's all sorts of categorizations. But in the green section of people who are clear about their stance, there are affirming and non-affirming churches in that category. So really it's all about how clear is that church in communicating their stance to those people who are interested in visiting the church. And so that's really their big point, is to say, yeah, we believe that honesty and clarity is the best thing for the church as a whole. So it's a really fascinating idea. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think it's great.
And for those who are interested in churches that are affirming, there are kind of two important benefits to this project. One is for LGBT people themselves, Christians who are looking to have a church home in which they can feel like they are part of the family. Like this is not a battle that they are having to fight. There are people who choose to stay in congregations and walk them through the process of discerning whether they want to be an affirming congregation. And I have nothing but the utmost respect for them, because that is tough. It's extremely hard to go through those conversations with members of your church family who are basically deciding whether they want to see you as a fellow child of God or not. And so one thing that this will do is to be able to point people to congregations so they won't, you know, visit a church, spend some time there, maybe decide to join, and then realize a few months or a few years in that they're not allowed to be in the choir or they're not allowed to teach Sunday school because of their identity. But there are also a growing number of people, and we know that younger Christians are more likely to fall in this group, who are looking for churches that are affirming, who don't want to be part of non-affirming churches. And Nisha, you know that I've been church shopping here for the past year since we moved. And man, it is tough, especially with kids. There are so many different factors to consider. So, you know, there are some things that are easy for me to figure out. I wanted to find a church that was multiracial and had people across economic classes, and multigenerational is another hard thing to find.
Oh, I love gray hair in the congregation. That's not just mine.
I loved having my kids raised in churches where they're around people from birth to like 99. It's so good for them. And so many of these new church plants, nothing against them, but there are a lot of 20 and 30 somethings. And it's just, it's not the same. It might be for me if I was single without kids, but that's not what I'm looking for right now. I can also tell if they have the attitude towards women and women's ordination that I want, because they've got women pastors. But I will say the one issue where I've had to have appointments with pastors to sit down and talk to them, and have one coming up before we officially join the church that I'm really hoping is going to work for us, is to ask, are you guys affirming or not? Because unless you've got a rainbow banner over the door outside.
That's right. Rainbow flag hanging outside.
It's yep. not always easy to tell. Being able to go to a place like Church Clarity and look up different churches, and we should note that they've just started out, so I think there's just, I think, less than 24 churches right now. But being able to do that will be a real useful tool for folks for whom this is a big issue when they decide which church to attend.
Yeah, the only the interesting piece of this story for me, I don't know if you've noticed it, but there has actually been pushback on this. Now, I am in the, I mean, if we're going to say camps or sides to this issue, I think that this is a bit more nuanced than this, than just two sides. But I think this is a great idea. I'm all about honesty and clarity. I never think there's a downside to being honest, right? At least over the long term. And so I think honesty is always going to be the best policy, to use that cliche. However, there are people that have given this a lot of pushback and said, oh, it smells of fundamentalism. We don't want to be put in a box. This should be contextualized within each individual community, and kind of giving it some fair critique and some not. I will say that the loudest opposition to Church Clarity has come from people who signed a statement on human sexuality and gender called the Nashville Statement that specifically asked for clarity on this issue and declared the need for clarity. Now, the Nashville Statement was a overwhelmingly very clear statement that was not affirming on any level. And there were scholars and there were pastors and lay leaders and authors and all sorts of people that signed the Nashville Statement. But in the preamble of the Nashville Statement, they said, you know, what we need now is clarity on this issue. And it's so interesting to me that,
what do you know?
Right. That like, oh, there are some non-affirming people, or there are some affirming people here that actually agree with you. We actually think that clarity is helpful as well. But then all of a sudden, affirming people agree, and it's like, oh, just kidding. Maybe clarity isn't that important. But, you know, I really struggle with that, because I have the firm belief that you let your yes be yes and your no be no. And if this is a big enough issue for your church to actually take a stance on it and to actually have an opinion, and you've actually wrestled it through and you are either affirming or non-affirming, this goes to both sides, that you should stand on it and you should be open and honest about your position. Just be honest. And if there is pushback to that, if there is criticism to that within the context of your congregation, then yeah, work that out. But if you really do believe that this is important enough to make a stand, then stand with 2 feet and stand on it and be honest about it. So,
yeah, if you're not being open about it because you want it to be a little muddy so that you don't turn off potential congregants, then that's not really the best motivation there.
That's exactly right. So I'm interested to see how it's going to pan out over the next 3, 6 months to a year, to see what are the types of churches that people are submitting through their crowdsourcing. Is it going to be all just big mega churches with big celebrity pastors, or are we going to start seeing small congregations? I'm really interested to see how it pans out and how churches respond, and how some of those bigger churches respond. Are they actually going to step forward and go, oh, you're right, we're not clear on this, and actually make their stances clear? Or will they continue to just ignore it and say, we don't really need to be super clear, we're just going to hide it a little bit.
Kick it down the road.
Yeah, that's right. We'll see. I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, our last big topic is the meeting down at First Baptist Church of Dallas, which happened last weekend. And Nish, if any of you heard some screaming coming from the direction of Utah last Sunday, it was probably Nish listening to this. So Robert Jeffress, who is the longtime pastor down there at First Baptist, and also a longtime, somewhat controversial figure in the Southern Baptist world, he's been known to question whether Catholics are actually Christians. He used to say that they might belong to a more pagan faith led by Satan, but apparently just this week he was walking that back a bit. So I know Robert Jeffress getting all wobbly on us now, but Jeffress hosted Fox News personality Sean Hannity, another one of your favorites, so that the two could plug their latest products. Jeffress has a new book out that earned a presidential endorsement tweet, and Hannity is promoting a conservative religious movie that he helped produce. Now, Nish, I know you have strong feelings about this conversation, but before we get to it, I just wanted to stop for a second to say I like to think of myself as someone who at least used to be up on Christian pop culture, but I am embarrassed to say I didn't even know about the series of movies that Hannity has been involved with.
To be fair, it's Sean Hannity.
It's Sean Hannity. I know, but...
I'm perfectly fine with you not knowing that Sean Hannity was involved in Christian movies, but please continue.
Well, I realized that I kind of dropped out of evangelical pop culture around the late 1980s when the Frank Peretti books were really big, and I read every single one of them. Then I started to read about the movie, and I realized that things have not changed so much. So in the Frank Peretti books, they always revolved around an antagonist who was like a college professor, a new agey college professor who is going to lead people astray in the town. And also always a liberal pastor who was like being a false prophet and through whom the demons could come to. It was a lot of spiritual warfare. It was intense. But these new movies, in this new one, Kevin Sorbo, who some of you may remember as Hercules on TV.
Oh, yes.
Stars as a militantly atheist professor. Not to be confused with the militantly atheist professor character he played in his last Christian film, which was called God's Not Dead. Now, I'm not going to name this movie because Sean Hannity is out there promoting it, and I'm not going to do his work for him. But I do find it amusing that the whole frame of Christian pop culture has not really changed one whit in the last 30 years.
Did you watch God's Not Dead?
I did not. No.
Yeah, I didn't either. Okay, good. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Nor did I watch any of the Left Behind movies. So
I did not watch the Left Behind movies.
Kirk Cameron.
Are we talking about like the Kirk Cameron or the Nicolas Cage version? Because they made a they had a remake. You know that, right?
They've been remade?
Oh, they remade it with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, dear Lord.
Nicolas Cage of...
All right, let's face just off. Pause for a moment of silence for Nick Cage's career. Yeah.
And The Rock. What was the name of that movie with Sean Connery?
It was The Rock.
Yeah. About Alcatraz, not to be confused with Dwayne Your The brother. Rock Johnson, who is now apparently my adopted brother. We can talk about it later. Anyway.
Right, yeah, let's continue.
Okay. That was a bunny trail of all bunny trails. First Baptist Church of Dallas hosts Sean Hannity. Okay, I need a minute to collect my thoughts because I just like slipped back into a black hole of rage. Okay. Sean Hannity at First Baptist Dallas. This was not like a Wednesday night, like additional church event.
Right. So this was the Sunday main service.
This was Sunday morning, a Sunday morning church service. Where everyone, like the choir, he even like turns and like looks at the choir and is like, thank you so much for this like wonderful uplifting music. I'm like, oh my God, Sean Hannity is at a church on Sunday morning as the guest and they're going to sit here and they're going to talk about politics and da 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 da. Oh my gosh. I was like fit of rage. It took me probably 10 tries to get through the first 15 seconds. It should go to show you how I feel about this situation.
Now, Nish, you're sounding like an intolerant liberal.
Oh, please. You know what? Fine. Because Sean Hannity, in the middle of this service, says in church, in the Sunday morning church service, he says, and I quote, I hate liberals, end quote. And gets, what does he get for that?
He gets an ovation.
Oh my gosh. He got so much applause.
Because what would Jesus do?
I can tell you what Jesus did. He would flip over all the tables, but that's neither here nor there. So Sean Hannity is there. They're talking about, you know, their projects in the state of America and the president. I mean, they're talking about all of these things, right? And the only thing that I can think of, like the word that keeps popping into my head, and I'm sure it does to you, is like this. It felt blasphemous to me. It felt like blasphemy to watch Sean Hannity, this, I mean, to call him partisan is actually really gentle and really soft. He is hyper partisan, like hyper partisan, conservative talk radio, Fox News propagandist in a Sunday morning, what is supposed to be a worship service where we are worshiping the life and ministry and work, reconciling work of Jesus Christ in service with our communities. And we're sitting here listening to who? Sean Hannity? Are you freaking kidding me? I cannot. Oh, I'm going to need you to take over.
Take a breath.
Because I am like,
take a breath. Yeah.
I get so angry. I get so angry when I think about it. But it really goes to show that there is this shift that has been happening within evangelicalism. And I think it's been actually happening for a really long time. And the election of Donald Trump really just made it evident that we have made this shift. I don't think that Trump is the cause of the shift.
Oh, absolutely not. No, no. I mean, Sean Hannity is the priest in a denomination called Fox Evangelicalism.
That's exactly right. And so,
and we have talked a lot in this country about the impact of religion on our politics. We have talked very, very little about the impact of our politics on religion. And particularly for conservative evangelicals, it has morphed into kind of a secular evangelicalism that is driven by values that I don't recognize as gospel values or Christian values.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, it is true that Trump is not the cause of any of this.
No.
He is, however, kind of the ideal empty vessel.
He's
to
the
be
icon
held up.
Of it.
He is the icon. You know, he's got Jeffress and all sorts of other folks, you know, laying hands on him in the Oval Office, literally laying hands on him and praying over him. And yet this is a man.
Oh, and what's her name? Paula White, right? Who, like, up until just like a couple of, just a couple of years ago, like, evangelicals were quick to call her a heretic, but now she's all pro-Trump and everyone's like, whoop-de-doo, awesome.
Still do.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I can't even
Well,
tell.
You know, so it's not too different. We shouldn't be surprised that we've got a president who names as his favorite Bible verse an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which, oh my goodness, where to begin? You could start with the fact that even in the Old Testament, that was never meant to be a, like, you know, go out and punch in the face anybody who hurts you. It was meant to put limits, in fact, on the vengeance that you could take, to say, basically, you can only take an eye for an eye. You can only take a tooth for a tooth. But even then, you know, Jesus came.
You have heard it
what
said.
What I so love, yes, about this selection of his favorite Bible verse is that, you know, in Matthew, it says precisely, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Love your enemies, Sean Hannity, who hates liberals. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you.
And all of God's people say amen.
It could not be more the opposite of the lesson that Trump and Hannity and O'Reilly and Jeffress and Jerry Falwell Jr. and all of these guys take from their distorted version of Christianity.
Yep. And this is the shift I'm talking about, is I think that there is a healthy way to engage in politics through your faith. And I think that we see a lot of churches and a lot of denominations do this well, where it is your faith. And the, you know, cornerstone of your faith is that reconciling work of Jesus for the sake of the world, and Jesus's command to love your God and love your neighbor. And so those things are the things that inform my politics, right? So then I look at politics through the lens of neighborliness. I look at politics through the lens of service and how do I serve the people that Jesus served first? How do I use politics? How do I use it as a tool? And how do I use public policy as a tool to serve the least of these, to serve those neighbors? And I think that there is a healthy marriage between, to use that term, between religion and politics. And we will continue to talk about this, you know, ad infinitum.
Absolutely. Well, we're almost out of time for this week. But before we go, we'd like to leave you every week with a recommendation or two, something to maybe lighten up your news consumption. So it could be a TV show, a podcast, a movie. Nish, what's been on your mind?
Okay, I'm so excited. I'm so excited to share mine. It is Stranger Things week. Have you watched Stranger Things?
Oh, I know. Are you one of these people?
I'm totally one of these people. Stranger Things is one of the most, like, it is the most fun I've had watching TV in years. It is so awesomely throwback. I love it. It's so 80s culture. But it's really well acted. It's got a great storyline. The young girl, Millie Bobby Brown, who plays the character Eleven, is out of this world. She's just phenomenal. And I am so excited. So season two launches on Netflix in totality. So all of the episodes at once for all of you bingers out there. I am unfortunately unable to binge because I have two young children who would never in a million years let me sit in front of the TV for like 8 hours.
You don't need sleep, Nish.
Right. Who needs sleep with small children? But that comes out, I think the official launch day is the 27th, which means sometime on the night of the 26th, probably at midnight, will the new episodes be released. So I am so excited. I love Stranger Things. I'm a total fangirl. I'm sorry.
Okay, well then answer me this, because it does, by the description of it, seem to be the type of show that I would get into, except everything I see written about it includes the fact that it's got some horror stuff. And it's not that I'm squeamish, it's just I simply don't care for horror. I can't watch Walking Dead. I find no interest in slasher films. I can't.
I wouldn't put it in the horror category at all. I would put it, the best way I can describe it, it's like if The X-Files meets The Goonies. That's how I would describe it. It's very sci-fi. Very, very sci-fi.
Now, here is one of my early but far from the last confessions as a child of the 80s and evangelicalism in the 80s.
Are you about to tell me you did not watch The Goonies?
Do you know how many 80s movies I've never seen?
Amy.
The Goonies is definitely among them. I know. I know.
I'm going.
We got pulled out of Ghostbusters the last 10 minutes because there was too much swearing. And I have still never seen the end of Ghostbusters. I know there's like supposedly the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, but I don't even know what that is.
I am not sure how to process this information. What I do know is that I'm going to go on Amazon and buy you a copy of The Goonies and have it shipped to your house. And that is your homework for next week, is to watch The Goonies. Who has not seen The Goonies? Oh my gosh. So good.
Amy and Katie Sullivan.
Okay. Well, there you go. So anyway, all that to say, you should watch Stranger Things because it's amazing. Amy, what are you watching this week? What is your recommendation? Show, movie, music? What have you got?
So Nish, I am so, so excited about this. I love Stevie Wonder in general. Just one of many things that Michelle Obama and I have in common. By the way, Mrs. Obama, my challenge for a hula hoop off still stands.
Ooh.
For whatever reason, she has never taken me up on this challenge. But
sign me up
still
and
stands.
Take my money.
Anyway, over the weekend, CBS aired an all-star tribute to Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. And there are so many wonderful performances in this. There was a medley in particular with Beyonce, Ed Sheeran, and Gary Clark Jr. that was so amazing.
Yes, please.
So plenty of it to watch. But the one song, if you just have time for one thing that I would commend to you, look it up on YouTube, was India RE, Jill Scott, and Janelle Monáe.
What? Yes,
together singing As. It is just a gorgeous.
That just made my heart skip a beat.
And it just spoke directly to my heart, and I just keep playing it on repeat. So.
Okay, and it was on CBS, you said, right?
CBS, yes. Check the website, check YouTube. You will not be sorry.
Okay, I'm going to go check it out. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe, and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we'll post links to our show notes for this week as well. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!